August 12th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl will present tubist, multi-instrumentalist, arranger, and composer, Howard Johnson. That's Sunday, August 12th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web. And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. And, yeah, that's it. That's the name of this program. And, we're gonna get this thing started really soon. And let's start it. Where is she? Oh, okay, there she is. Let's start it off with our queen, Nina Simone. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Sugar in My Bowl, as I said, is the name of this program. Stay tuned.
I want a little sugar in my bowl. I want a little sweetness down in my soul. I could stand some loving, oh, so bad. I feel so funny, I feel so sad. I want a little steam on my clothes. Maybe I can fix things up so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I need some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar in my bowl. Been acting different, I've been told. Soothe me, I want some sugar in my bowl. I want some steam on my clothes. Maybe I can fix things up so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I want some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar in my bowl.
And you are listening to Sugar in My Bowl. My name's Joyce Jones, and our guest for this evening is Howard Johnson, tubist and multi-instrumentalist, arranger and composer, and father of blues performer who's now at the Michigan Women's Music Festival, Nedra Johnson. Stay tuned. I'm going to play something that we didn't get a chance to talk about this, but he did play with this person. Stay tuned. You'll hear it.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm
And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. I'm having a little difficulty here. Yeah. And until I get the difficulty solved, it's not the equipment's fault. It's definitely not anybody here's fault. It is my own. So I'm going to play a recording from someone, well, Howard Johnson is featured on this. So, let's see. Which one will I do? Where are my glasses? Gosh. Let's do the first one. Can't hurt there. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, Sugar in My Bowl, waiting for Howard Johnson.
That's how love's going since you came to me. I dare not question why our love should be. I only pray that it will last. When we embrace, we blend so perfectly that violence play like in those old movies, when lovers know just what to say. And when it's heavenly when I'm with you, things go so perfectly. Darling, it's true, because we're meant to be.
You wouldn't forget him either if you had met him where I met him. Talking about desolation. Lord, desolation is a railroad station round about 2 a.m. on a weeknight. When you walk into desolation like that, and suddenly, out of nowhere, comes a warm song, you aren't about to forget him. This is the first time, though, that I've heard him at an airport. I know he moves along the piers. He calls himself a journey agent, a Ulypian. Says his friends, the poets and the artists and musicians, are Ulypians, too. Hey, listen. Listen to his tune. Calls it his duty-free gift for the traveler.
Thank you.
Hi, you're listening to Sugar in My Bowl. My name is Joyce Jones, and my guest is...
Howard Johnson.
Greetings, Howard Johnson. Thank you for joining Sugar in My Bowl. Thank you for coming into WBAI.
Happy to do it.
I should start at the beginning. That's always a better place to start. You were born in Alabama, huh?
Yes.
Montgomery.
Right.
What was it like growing up down there? What was the music like?
I didn't really grow up down there.
I
grew up in Massillon, Ohio. But it was strange because much of the black community of Massillon, Ohio came from the same two or three counties of Alabama. And especially in the case of my family, during the war where there was work for the men in the steel mills, that was much better than any black person could get anywhere in Alabama. And so when the family moved up there, I was only two. But what I meant when I said they're all from the same part of Alabama is that the churches were Southern. Food was Southern.
Mm.
Our little friendships in the schools tended to be Southern, you know.
Did you attend church?
I did.
Did you play music in the church?
No. There wasn't much in the way of instrumental music in those days except the piano and the organ.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I look at the bands that the churches have now and
right.
I say, boy, I wish that was happening when I was growing.
Right.
It would have been easier to listen to some of those sermons.
Right. I know, by the time I went, there was piano and organ, but inevitably they added drums at some mm-hmm. point, and that made it more exciting for me.
In my town, the Holiness Church had the drums, and they were considered much too pagan.
Exactly. and it's hard to believe that there are actually churches at present that are still skittish about drumming mm-hmm. in the church.
Yes, and they wanted not only all that gospel shouting, but they wanted some anthems and things like that, too, you know.
So, right. Well,
that was all right. I mean, they did that piece called Holy, Holy, Holy
mm-hmm.
in the original harmony and everything, you know. So they had worked out some stuff.
Right. So I suspect that your introduction to instruments was in high school then.
In junior high, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, I started out being a not very dedicated drummer.
Oh.
Or what I'd have to say is percussionist, because there was no drum set in the school band. But I liked being in the band, but I didn't apply myself very much. My band director just kind of tolerated me and a few of the other, what he called, clowns.
Uh-oh. Were you acting up in school, or were you a funny guy, or...
I think it had to do with his own frustration about how he would have liked to have been a musician at that time.
I see.
And these things actually came true for him a little later. He was a very fine clarinet player, and they started a symphony nearby, and he became the principal.
Oh, okay.
But I didn't start getting serious about music until I, quite by accident, started playing the baritone sax, because I found one in the music room, and I didn't know what it was. I asked the same band director, and he said, "That's a baritone sax. Want to play it?" Because he definitely didn't need me clanging around on the cymbals and stuff in the percussion section.
Uh-huh.
So I said, "Well, okay. What does it do?" And he said, "Well, it's a logical bass instrument of the saxophone section, and they have them in dance bands." I wasn't sure what he meant by dance bands, but I started hearing that instrument, and you know, with Harry Carney and Duke Ellington's band.
Oh, okay.
I could hear it in Count Basie's band. And also, that turned out to be the instrument that played that lick in rock and roll, you know, boom, boom, dump, boom, boom, dump, dump.
Right.
It's like, oh, well, you know. But in the school band setting, it was much like tuba parts. You know, it was the kind of thing where, even if your band didn't have a tuba player, you could make your worst saxophone player oink out those parts on the baritone, you know.
Okay.
And it was like, not like the majestic tuba, you know, which played those notes in a way that I always liked, even when I was a percussionist. And I thought, what a cool instrument. I never thought of playing it. I never had the faintest thought of, I'll be a tuba player. It was just kind of... again, by accident. Because, see, the band director who encouraged me to play it also proposed to teach me how to play it, because I'd never played a instrument with notes before. But we only got two lessons into it before his schedule changed, and I'd learned two scales in those two lessons. His schedule changed. He said, take it home and come to the summer band, the summer junior high school band, and see what you can find out. So I had to find all the rest of the notes myself and all the fingerings. And
wow. Okay.
So, I'd fool around, squeak, 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 bah, a note. Okay. So I never really had any lessons on that. And even less on the tuba, because the next year, since we were playing similar parts, I noticed something similar about the right-hand fingering of those two instruments. It just made me curious. Hmm. And at a certain point, I felt like, hey, I think I know a whole chromatic scale. And I went and got one of the guy's tubas and proved it to myself by playing this chromatic scale on it. But we were definitely not allowed to play other kids' school-owned instruments. Mm. That was the thing that he was really heavy on. Mm-hmm. Same band director, different school.
Okay. Oh, okay.
And I looked up, and he was back in the room and caught me playing. So I decided to slink back over to my chair, and he came over and he said, when did you start playing that, and how long have you been playing? And I thought, I'm 13, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm, and this is a big authority figure.
Right.
And even though it's late in May, I know I'd be under detention for the rest of the school year. So I said, Mr. Reed, I know I shouldn't have done that. I'm very sorry, and I won't ever do it again. I still like the irony of that. So he said, no, what I mean is, when did you first start to play? I said, just now.
Wow.
And he said, well, how did you know what to play? I said, well, I watched the tuba players and I learned the fingering. He said, yeah, but how did you learn how to get a tone? I said, do I have a tone? He said, well, yeah, you do. He said, it usually takes people weeks, sometimes months, before they can even get a sound, let alone articulate anything in a chromatic scale.
Well, didn't he instruct you to go home and play with it?
That was the other instrument.
Oh, the this baritone sax.
This was a year later.
Okay.
So he said, well, you're going to the high school next year. They're going on a trip to California for the Tournament of Roses parade. It'll be the first time they had a band east of the Mississippi. I think you'd like to make that trip. You can have a better chance of making the band on tuba because they don't march baritone sax. Like a lot of competition in the drums, you were not that good in the first place.
Oh, goodness.
And they need tuba players.
Uh-huh.
So that was kind of a done deal. But all I really took away from that was no detention.
Great. Did you switch schools because that band leader was there or he just happened to be there?
No, he had both of those junior highs.
I see.
But I did move. We had been living in very dodgy, poor conditions up until about then, about my eighth grade year. And we moved out of that dilapidated place where we had been into a real house where humans should live.
How did that happen? How did you wind up with the house?
My whole time in school, and in fact, the family's fortunes were kind of guided by my mother, who, when she came to Ohio, didn't have any real job or skills, except she was good at doing hair.
Oh.
You know what doing hair means.
Yes.
Yeah, well, she would do that, but she was bootlegging because she wasn't licensed,
Mm-hmm. Right.
So she managed to take a year off and go to school, which was more serious today. I mean, you can be a hairdresser in 3 weeks today.
Right, right.
But it was a school year for her at that time. And so by the time, we were in that revolting little old shack for a long time, which I thought was great. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was home, right?
Right.
I didn't know I was ever going to get any better.
Sure.
So she moved us from those conditions to pretty firmly middle class by the time I graduated high school.
Wow.
And then when all the kids were away, folks did very well.
Okay.
But that's kind of rare sociologically because sometimes you'll have a family's fortunes change overnight through a business paying off or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But a steady growth out of poverty and into not only having more resources, but being able to think a different way.
Sure.
You know, being able to look at the future in a different way and look back and say, gee, why did we do that? That didn't make any sense. You know, because that's what poor people do. They do that stuff we were doing.
Mm.
And then we got better.
Now, this was as a result of your mother doing hair.
And just looking out anyway, you know, just looking forward.
Oh, okay.
And kind of dragging my father along because he was kind of recalcitrant. And the biggest fights I ever saw him have, he would be saying, well, this is good enough. And she'd be saying, this is not good enough.
Okay.
So it wasn't just the money thing.
So you're playing tuba now in high school.
Yeah, I got to be a very good player very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
It all seemed very natural and organic to me at the time, but people were kind of astounded at what I could do over that summer.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know there was anything particularly fantastic about what I was doing because it all, again, I didn't have a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So there was nobody to say, don't try that. And if you do that, you'll mess up this and, you know, all those things. And I found out none of that was true anyway.
Oh.
I mean, people were telling me that I couldn't do what I could do after I was already doing it.
Wow.
I said, well, how can I listen to them?
Right.
You can't do what you just did. So it took me a long time to figure out there's anything extraordinary about it at all. You know, what's the fuss, you know?
Yeah. Do you think it was better for you learning that way as opposed to some formal rudimentary something?
55 years later.
Yeah.
I'd have to say that's what I should have done.
Yeah.
I ended up having the same principles and, you know, musical values as anybody, classical players and whatever. And that's, I always think most of really good playing is conceptual.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to have something you want to play, and then you make your instrument do that, or it beats you up. Or But eventually you do everything you came there to do.
When did you, I'm going to fast forward now, when did you start gigging?
Well, I used to go out with my sister, who was what was called at the time an exotic dancer.
Oh.
Now, in those days, you did something that had some eroticism to it, but you didn't show everything.
Right.
And you had to be dancing. You had to know how to dance.
Right.
Because, you know, the audience knew better.
Right.
And the audience was, you know, men and women. She would be invited to do like a 20-minute set at a function that they were having, in a, you know, some kind of affair that they'd booked a space for.
Mm-hmm.
And she found that, now this is the middle 50s, so she would make a princely $35.
Wow.
For a gig like that. And it was only for 20 minutes, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if it worked out logistically as far as driving the car and everything, she could book more than one such thing because she was in demand.
Oh, okay.
And so the only thing that kept her from being able to do that was that she'd have to go to the place. She'd have to break the band in on what she wanted them to do.
Hmm.
First, find out what they can play.
Oh.
And then get dressed, do her number, get undressed, get back in the car. She could usually only do one or maybe two if it just happened to be close enough on a given Saturday, Friday night. But she decided to take me along with my baritone sax, and I would deal with the band.
Oh, okay.
And I would also jam with them in the meantime. That's where I got some of my first experience playing with rhythm sections.
Excellent.
And, you know, I'd see her come flying out of the dressing room ready to go back to go to the next gig.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's what I would have to call my first gig. She was able to do three sometimes, you know. And from that, she would pay me like $15 for the evening.
Oh, okay.
I was in power. I was like, yes, the world is mine.
Now, when you were discussing how the band should play, how were you able to do that? Did you have a musical language?
Well, I had the language that competent musicians use. You know? I was stuck with that.
Okay.
And some bands, they were cracking. They were great, you know, and they knew what I was talking about. And they appreciated that I would lay this on them.
Okay.
I'd have to set the tempos because she did her thing in two different tempos. So I'd have to count the things off.
Mm-hmm.
And mostly the bands were, they were pretty good and cooperative, but some didn't know anything but the blues in F sharp or something like that.
Okay.
Because the black keys of the piano represent a pentatonic scale.
Uh-huh.
And they learned by playing the boogie-woogie thing on the black keys. Doom, 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 like that, you know.
Right. So how old were you around that time? Do you remember?
Oh, 14, 15.
Oh, my goodness. I was expecting you to say older.
And then I would sometimes go up to Cleveland, which is only 60 miles away, and jam with some cats up there that I knew through my sister again.
Oh, okay.
My sister Terry.
Were you a working musician at that point? I mean, were you? Was that your
vocation? I was in high school.
Okay.
And as soon as I got out of high school, I was going to go somewhere else.
Okay.
So I never got deep on that circuit or that scene in Cleveland, you know.
Okay.
Or anywhere else around that. I went into the service after I went into the Navy, you know, so I could go to that so-called Naval School of Music.
Oh, yeah. How was that? Because I've, you know, I've understood Freddie Hubbard, you know, James Spalding. A lot of people used to play music
being
in the military.
In military bands, yeah. I didn't do that much. They were very displeased with me at that school and threw me out.
Oh, no.
Yeah, they it was that military thing, you know. They said that I couldn't be a major on baritone sax because I had to either have it play a tenor or alto. And if I didn't play clarinet, I have to become a beginner on clarinet. Well, I didn't have much interest in doing that. And I said, well, how about if I'm a tuba player then? Because I auditioned for that school on both those instruments and was accepted with high marks.
Mm-hmm.
And this was just my inexperience because the guy who was issuing the instruments was just trying to get us off his hands. So he said, well, yeah, you can be a tuba player, but you have to be a beginner on the string bass. Now, that was not a bad idea.
Huh.
But I'd hurt my hand in boot camp, and I wasn't able to play a bass. I hurt my left hand.
Oh, okay.
And he said, listen, I ain't got it all day. You're now an alto sax and clarinet player. Pushed the instruments at me and said, next. So, no, I never gained any proficiency. You know what I was saying about things being conceptual?
Mm-hmm.
I still can't see me playing those instruments. Although I did become a better clarinet and bass clarinet player.
So you get out of the military, and then you do what?
Well, because I didn't get to prepare the way I wanted to prepare in those 3 years, I said, well, I'm doing pretty well as an improviser, but I may need a little more seasoning. So instead of coming straight to New York, I went to Chicago, proposing to be there 2 years.
Hi, you're listening to Sugar My Bowl. My name is Joyce Jones, and my guest is...
Howard Johnson.
Greetings, Howard Johnson. Well, what do you know? Why did that do that? That had no business doing that. That's not fair. Oh, goodness, you know... This has been an adventure today, tonight, this morning. Well, let's see. What am I going to do instead of trying to figure out why this did what it did? Let me... Okay. Let's do this. Let's find a recording that... This is magic, I tell you. Magic! That Howard's daughter, Nidra, did with Howard Johnson, our guest for this evening. Which recording is that? Oh, glasses. I tell you. Why? Why do you do these things? Why? Okay. Well, let's do this one. Oh.
Man, this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program that is taking a strange nosedive this evening. Wow, that's not fair. Okay. Well, let's do this. This ought to work. And hopefully he will be on this week. Oh, there he is. Okay, that's a good one. Stay tuned. This is WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM. Sugar in My Bowl.
She's a bandit. She's a bandit.
Bandit.
She is a bandit, yeah, yeah.
She's a bandit.
I went to visit her. She came to get me. That them has two hearts. That's why she swept me. And I would be a boy for her. If only she would let me, I'd be a boy. Her loving boy. She treats me like a kid. I treat her like a queen. I learned her language, so I know just what she means. And between the two of us, we'd lick the platter clean. If only she would let me be hers. And she is first the lady,
first the lady.
Governess of the moon. She give me wax anyway. Gelato
juice.
Yeah.
She's a bandit.
She is a bandit. Yeah, yeah.
And she's a bandit.
She took what was nothing and made it something. Not a criminal or thief.
Bandit,
Lord, what you took from me. My whole life I've been named
bandit.
Baby, you have set me free. Won't you say that I can be yours?
She's a bandit.
Not a criminal or thief.
Bandit,
Lord, what she took from me. My whole
She's
life I've been in bondage. Baby, you have set me free. Won't you say that I can be yours?
She's a
the kind of boy that makes her fun.
Being
in service to the right woman.
And being
told it was a job well done.
If it was well done.
Well done. Sir,
she's the kind of boy that makes her fun.
Well done, servant.
Being in service to the right woman.
Well done, sir.
And he told it was a job well done.
Servant, well done. Yeah,
done.
Well done, sir.
She's the kind of boy that makes her fun.
Well done, servant.
Being in service to the right woman.
Well done, sir.
Now, you eventually wound up attending Charles Mingus's workshop.
Mm-hmm. Quite a lot.
How did you wind up getting into that sphere?
You're fishing all of my stories.
That's it.
You know, I have more extended versions of everything that I'm beginning to do as monologues or, in spoken word circumstances, And I do have a Mingus monologue and a Gil Evans monologue and a Duke Ellington monologue, because I played with the Ellington band for a couple of weeks just in the year before Duke died.
Oh, okay. Well, what's happening with these monologues?
Well, I'm going to find out. You got any connections?
Oh.
Hook me up, baby. The Mingus thing was right out of a bad movie.
Uh-oh.
Starring Ruby Keeler or somebody.
Oh, goodness.
I don't remember where I had been, but I had my tuba with me, and I stopped in the 5 spot to hear that band. At the 5 spot, the owners knew me. They'd seen me play a few times, so they knew I was a player, but they didn't like cats coming in and just hanging out and not spending any money. And that's what I was doing. They were kind of eyeing me. I wasn't very comfortable. And the band wasn't on the bandstand yet. I hadn't really even taken a seat. I was well in the back, and it was dark, and I was just kind of standing there. Mingus and the band came out of the back room, and Mingus was upset about something. It turned out he had just heard from his very good friend and his very first bass teacher, Red Callender. Red Callender had played with him in his triumphant gig at Monterey that year, the Mingus at Monterey record, and played tuba, because Red Callender is a very good tuba player and a real jazz player. So he played Mingus's tuba parts for that. And Mingus was going into Birdland the next week with a big band like that. So he had asked Red to come, and Red couldn't get out of his studio commitments. Mingus had just gotten that word, and he didn't want to use any of the New York cat. He didn't know anything about me. So when the band came out, Jackie Byard said, "Oh, there's your tuba player right over there." Mingus, one of his privileges of having a jazz workshop was it allowed him to do anything.
Right.
Stop the band if they made a mistake, rehearse little parts and stuff like that. Mingus, just about any time he said anything on the bandstand, he said it on mic. So he was looking through me in the dark like that, and he was saying, "That kid over there? Yeah, he's got a tuba, but can he play it?" And Jackie Byard didn't really know my playing, so he didn't want to commit to too much. He said, he's quite good. He said, "Yeah, but does he play behind the beat like other tuba players?" And Jackie didn't want to say. He said, "Well, why don't you ask him?" Yeah. By this time, the audience is turning to me, turning to Mingus, wondering what's going on.
Right.
And Mingus is still looking at me very suspiciously. Mm-hmm. And he says, "What tunes do you know?" Now, I didn't understand the question. I mean, I'm a New York jazz musician. I know what tunes I need to know. You know, I'm deep in the standards. I'm keeping up with the new stuff, and I'm digging Coltrane and everything.
Uh-huh.
So I didn't know what he meant. So I said, "What tune do you want to hear?" And the audience said, "Whoa." And the band, he was like, like I'd thrown him a challenge or something, which I hadn't intended to do.
Of course.
Why did I say that? And they said, "Oh, you're bad, huh? Well, come on up here. We're going to see about this."
Uh-oh.
Well, that was Mingus's privilege to do that. That was because he had the jazz workshop.
Right.
So that meant he could speak on the mic, he could chasten the guys, he could audition me or whatever he wanted to do. So he pulled me up. Now, I knew I could handle it musically. I just didn't want him to punch me out.
Which, of course, you had heard his want to do.
He's a pretty volatile guy.
Yes.
So he called some medium tempo blues, and I played a few choruses on that. And he said, "Well, you were doubling up pretty good." In other words, playing 16th notes instead of 8th notes on a certain part. He said, "But does that mean you could handle an up-tempo tune?" I said, "Oh, yeah, I can." He said, "Well, you couldn't play like a Cherokee, could you?"
Ooh.
I said, "Well, yeah. I mean, I was prepared."
Okay.
So I did that, and before we'd end the tune or anything like that, he'd say, okay, that's enough, And the audience was getting a real audition and not performance.
Right.
I mean, it was of course, a performance, but, it was loose.
Right.
So he hired me.
Oh.
be here at the 5 spot tomorrow at 3 o'clock for the first rehearsal.
Wow.
And that's how I started with Mingus.
So when did you decide that you were going to move on from playing with Mingus?
I don't think that ever happens. I mean, I hadn't really been trying to assert myself as a leader at all. Pretty much never did in those days. I only started to do it, you know, do little quartet things at Slugs and places like that. And I was doing quite a bit of studio work.
Yes.
And I was also playing with Archie Shepp.
Right. Yeah, you're on Mama Too Tight.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh, I love that song. All right. What you're listening to in the background is Mama Too Tight by Archie Shepp. I'm not going to say too much because you know I love this song. I did say that. Yeah, I'm juggling in here. It's one of those nights. And you're listening to Sugar My Bowl. My name's Joyce Jones, and I'm having a conversation with Howard Johnson, tubist, multi-instrumentalist, and arranger and composer. And we had a little mishap. Now, that wasn't my fault. I think we're back on track now. And stay tuned for more. What you've heard me play, well, it's been an emergency. I played a couple of cuts from Rosson Roland Kirk, The Return of the 50-Pound Man, 50,000-Pound Man. And let's see, I played something from Lil Phillips. Her release is titled Pull Out Those Dreams. Yeah, before that, we started off the program with McCoy Tyner, Man from Tanganyika. And this is from a compilation, The Best of McCoy Tyner, but it originally came from Tender Moments. A release of McCoy Tyner's, and Howard Johnson's on there. So Howard Johnson tends to play tuba. That's why it's number one. He also plays he also plays baritone sax, Barry sax. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York 99.5 FM, Sugar in My Bowl. My name's Joyce Jones. Please stay tuned.
That's an amazing record.
Oh, yeah.
And the side of that that has a portrait of Bob Thompson,
mm-hmm.
that was basically our set, only for the LP that we did it on. We did it for, I think, 26 minutes or something
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
But in the clubs, we'd go hour and a half, and just real intense blowing.
Wow.
Avant-garde to the hilt, you know, Roswell Rudd, Beaver
yeah,
Harris,
yeah,
Charlie
yeah.
Hayden, and yeah, me and Archie. And that was an amazing thing. It actually cured the worst headache I ever had in my life. It was the only time I ever had a migraine, and I could hardly see when I came into the club. And the thought of playing the tuba was just frightening. But I found out that while I was blowing, the pressure equalized somehow in my head,
huh.
and the pain went away.
Wow.
When I would stop to take a breath, the pain would come surging back. But if I started the breath in time, I could obey it once again, you know. So I never stopped blowing. I
oh.
took the shortest time breath.
And, wow.
And just kept blowing, and after a set of that, it was done.
Wow.
I told Shep, don't expect that intensity all the time.
Now, we went to Shep because you were talking about the session gigs that you were doing,
mm-hmm.
but we never actually finished your talking about transitioning from Mingus.
Mingus transitioned himself. You know,
okay.
this is 66. This is when he had all those difficulties, 66, 67, when he had those difficulties and got put out of his place and all that. He didn't just disappear out of my life. I didn't necessarily want to be in everything he was doing, but,
right.
you know, you talk to young cats and they know that you've done these kind of things, you know, and
mm-hmm.
they're so amazed. And I tell them, well, we had to have something going to get called for those gigs. But if you were in New York and trying to be a jazz musician in the 60s,
mm-hmm.
who was even going to call you but the greats?
Right, right.
Because they had the gigs.
Right.
You know, so you're going to work with Dizzy Gillespie and mm-hmm. Mingus and Art Blakey and Max Roach.
Well, you worked with Hank Crawford as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Starting at that time.
Yeah.
And then his later records that had a horn section that big, I was in all of those.
What was your first recording? Do you remember that one?
Yeah, it was a thing with Bill Dixon in 64, I guess.
Thank you.
Bill Dixon was amazing. I mean, he's thoroughly into Miles, you know. Mm. He never played anything like Miles.
No.
He never played anything like anybody.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, what he got out of the trumpet and the flugelhorn weren't even always notes, but there was such great expression. They really sounded like they needed to be there.
I'm hesitant about using the phrase, but I suspect that Bill Dixon was pretty much put into the avant-garde category.
Oh, firmly, I would say.
Yeah. And I guess my curiosity around that is, it seemed as though a lot of, quote, jazz artists at that time were exploring in that way and could very easily be in that category.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, almost everybody had a point at which they considered something that they heard or something they were doing was too out.
Mm.
Like, and then a lot of guys just, they didn't want to hear anything like that. A lot of listeners too, you know,
right.
They really considered that beyond. And, you know, it really was a break from what had been.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't trying to be that anymore. For me, I would try to make the most out of whatever I was doing and make it music, and it didn't have to follow a prescribed path. That's very liberating.
Yeah. You know?
But when it comes to what I want to put together for myself, it's almost always a good deal more inside.
Inside,
maybe. As opposed to outside.
Okay.
You know, I heard Mercury went direct. That's what I heard. I was told Mercury went direct, and all of this equipment should be working properly. And you know, I did this thing earlier. I said it wasn't my fault, and it wasn't. You know, it was my fault earlier. This is not my fault. This is the equipment. And you know, I usually don't like when people do that, but let's try this again. Ha 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 Yes, you know I don't like to talk over music, but this is how we get our opportunity to let you know what's going on. You just heard, you're listening to a second version of Blues in Orbit. The first version was from Gil Evans' recording Svengali. And we are now listening to the original, apparently, that was issued later after the fact. From the title, this is the title cut from Blues in Orbit, the Bill Evans Orchestra. And we're going to start, like I said, we're going to start going into the Gil Evans area. So brace yourselves. Oh, it's not that intense, but it's good stuff. And just to let you know, there is a Suga and My Bowl site, SUGAandMyBowl.org. And that's where the remainder of this show is going to be played. There are extras. We talked a long time. Howard Johnson and myself talked for about 2 hours. And to sort of shave everything and provide enough music was not going to be an easy task. So we've decided, Hank Williams and myself, my partner in this Suga and My Bowl venture, we're going to put up an extra. We have an extra, extra. It's Suga and My Bowl extra. So this program, which you will not be able to hear this evening, you can hear the rest of it at sugaandmybowl.org. It should be there by Wednesday. No later than Wednesday. No, Tuesday. No later than Tuesday. I promise. Along with a playlist. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York 99.5 FM. The name of this program is Suga and My Bowl. My name's Joyce Jones, and my guest for the evening is Howard Johnson. Stay tuned. Oh, and by the way, if you need to know something immediately, you can certainly call in the studio at 212-209-2900. It's 212-209-2900. Wind up working with him.
He came to see me when I was with Mingus.
Oh, okay.
And I thought, wow, Gil Evans, and how's my chance? Because, see, I had heard Gil Evans back in 57 when Miles Ahead first came out.
Right.
And it just knocked me down.
Yeah. You know,
I was walking somewhere, and I had the little Motorola transistor radio.
Uh-huh.
And the DJ said, the music I'm going to play tonight has no endings and beginnings. So I'm going to do all my announcements and commercials before and after the music. It's a new one by Miles Davis and a large ensemble under the direction of Gil Evans. I'd never heard of Gil Evans before.
Right.
So I'm thinking, Miles in a big band, this has got to be corny. And then they started playing it. They played Springsville. And I was like, whoa, there's a tuba in this, you know, mm-hmm. and, you know, French horns and all kind of stuff. And Miles is playing, you know, I'm like, whoa, man. I really was just about frozen in my tracks because I was supposed to be walking somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
It was only a half-hour jazz program that was once a week in my town on its local radio station. And after it, the last piece, he says, next week, side two. In his FM radio voice.
Right.
I got my hands on anything that had Gil Evans' name on it, and it turned out this guy is amazing. He's bringing some stuff into the world that nobody else can. You know, I love that. And he's doing it with a tuba player, too.
Mm-hmm.
I finally heard The Birth of the Cool.
Oh.
And even with that small of a band, there was a tuba and a French horn. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, yeah. By the time Porgy and Bess came out, it felt like there was a subliminal message to me to come to New York and play with Gil. So that was my intention. He was there listening to Mingus. I couldn't even tell if he was enjoying what he was hearing or not. And after the set, I put my instrument in the back, and I came back out, and he was gone. I was like, oh, no. You know, I'd been looking for him for 3 years already in New York. And I thought, oh, what's going to happen? So a few days later, he called me because he called Mingus and got my number.
Oh.
And
Mingus gave it.
Yeah. You know what? Mingus was a good old soul.
Uh-huh.
You know, he really was. I think that a lot of stuff that people can throw off. Because, you know, we run into racism every day, you know.
Right.
We run into a guy who just gives you an offhand response to something. And then this guy's an idiot, you know. We don't carry that around. But a lot of stuff that offhand way white people would have of dealing with you, that stuff lingered with me just a little bit, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it just colored everything else he did a lot of times.
Right.
And
especially since he was trying to have his music taken seriously mm-hmm. by their establishments.
Yeah, and more than deserved to, you know.
Right.
He wasn't even permitted to audition for orchestras, you mm-hmm. know, which he was prepared and trained to play in, you know.
Sure.
They went, oh, no, couldn't do that. And they tell him that he didn't play well enough. This is without hearing him, you know.
Mm.
You have to read. You have to know how to read. You have to, you know, stuff like that, which had happened years before, he was still carrying around. And so I gave him a lot of slack for that and a lot of latitude. You know, it was difficult for him already, and he made it more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually did get along.
Mm-hmm.
He could feel my understanding, I believe.
Mm-hmm. He gave Gil Evans your phone number.
Yeah.
And Evans called you.
Yeah. And we did some rehearsal with New York, but he wasn't able to take the whole band out to California. So he took Johnny Coles, Billy Harper, whom he had also just discovered.
Oh.
Yeah, he discovered us weeks from each other.
Oh, okay.
And Elvin Jones. Although he didn't play all the gigs, because when we were in L.A., Ray Brown wanted to play with the band.
Oh.
Don Moore.
Ray Brown's bassist.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and we had brought Don Moore out to play bass. You know?
Oh, I see.
And that was it. We got the rest of the guys on the West Coast. So that was about a 14, 15-piece band.
Were you recording during that
trip? I don't think any of that got officially recorded at all.
Oh, okay. What was your first recording with?
With Gil?
Yeah.
It was something, it never had a proper name on it. It had Gil Evans' name on it, and it had a weirdly made cover and all that.
Mm.
But it's available now. Blues in Orbit.
I think. Okay.
That was way after we did it, though.
Oh, okay.
They released it with that ugly cover at the time. It never went very far.
Mm.
And, the one thing that bugged me is that the name of the record company, which was Ampeg, or Ampex, or Ampex.
Okay.
Drawing was what I considered ugly. And the most compelling thing on it was the company logo.
Oh, goodness.
It was almost like the record was called Ampex.
Oh.
You know, bad idea.
Well, there's one performance that you put forward that really stands out from the Jimi Hendrix. What is it? Gil Evans plays Jimi Hendrix.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a version of
Voodoo Child.
Voodoo Child. Yeah. Yes. That's it.
Thank you.
About your just playing with Gil Evans. What was that for you once you finally got a chance to really get in there?
I mean, people have said this way back in the days of when he was writing for Claude Thornhill, that if you're in a big band, you know, and you're not the lead trumpet player, the lead alto player, or the solo tenor player, or any of that, the parts that you're playing, just the internal parts, you know, are exciting. You know, they're good voice leadings, you know. You can hear what your note is doing to the whole thing. And that means in the writing, there's a lot of human involvement. You want a person to play this note and express it according to the value it has in the whole chord or context. Those things were done in the 50s and 60s. But that same music holds up so well.
Yes.
I played it a couple of years ago at the Hollywood Bowl. We did the concert with Vince Mendoza conducting, and with Terrence Blanchard and Nicholas Payton playing the Miles parts. Sketches of Spain,
oh, wow.
Porgy and Bess, and Miles Ahead. Now, we're doing that this year in New Jersey, in Newark, at NJPAC.
What? When?
November the 20th.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that one.
Yeah. And,
oh, my goodness.
And you'll hear guys playing that same music, what, 50 years later, and the same magic happens.
Wow.
In fact, that concert we did at the Hollywood Bowl and this one are called Still Ahead.
Nice.
And it is still a hit.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It was just a magician in putting together sounds that are so killing. You know?
Yeah.
That's why Jerry Mulligan called him Svengali, which is an anagram for Gil Evans.
That's right.
Billy and I play on his tune Thoroughbred on that one.
That's it. That was Billy Harper's song that Gil Evans called Thoroughbred. It was something else when Billy Harper wrote it.
Really?
Yeah, it was actually, oh, what was it? So you were in and out with Gil Evans for 20 years.
22,
what I
yeah.
22, wow.
Mm-hmm.
And then you formed Gravity.
Mm-hmm.
When was that formed initially?
Okay, this is what happened. If you don't talk to me or some of the other people who were there, you won't know this. It hasn't been documented, it hasn't been recorded. I was living for some months in California in 1967, and I suddenly realized there are a couple guys that I knew who were getting to be pretty good on tuba. So I thought, what if there was a tuba ensemble? You know, now with my own range on the low tuba, the B-flat tuba, I was well into what's the trombone's range. And if you can have a trombone section, maybe you can have a tuba section. So I was thinking that when I came back to New York in 67 and got right back into the scene in good fashion with a lot of good recordings and stuff. And these tuba players were around somehow. If I have four or five voices, maybe I'll have a euphonium on the top or something. Mm-hmm. But I discovered that I didn't really need the euphonium, and tuba on top sounded better for a tuba section. And pretty soon there were five of us, including Bob Stewart. He was living in Philly at that time, and we'd hang out on weekends, you know. And I said, I want to keep a steady rehearsal schedule on Thursdays, and I can't ask you to come Thursday and then go back and teach Friday and then come back up Friday, because he had gigs himself. I said, you know, so you kind of can't be in the band. He said, well, do you mind if I come anyway? And I said, well, I didn't know what to do quite about that. He always showed up, but there was always something for him to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, wait a minute here. So at a certain point, there were five of us in the ensemble. Great rhythm section with Herb Buschler, Warren Smith, and George Cables.
Oh, on piano.
Yeah. This is in 1968. This is in the spring of 1968. And Jim Harrison, our friend, the great Jim Harrison, booking Slugs at that time. And he had this idea to do these Sunday afternoon concerts, you know, like between 5:30 and 8. Something like that. So I said, you know, why don't you book my band for those Sundays in June? And he said he would. He had no idea what five tubas was going to sound like. And the band was called The Substructure at that time.
Uh-huh.
It morphed into Gravity later. So we had posters made up and used a drawing of mine, a cluster of five tubas, for the poster. And it's been my logo ever since.
Huh.
So we went and did the first of those gigs. It was a mild sensation. You know, the people who did come said, man, you're not going to believe this. Well, what's it like? Nobody can tell you. And after the second of those Sundays, he gave us July also.
Oh, wow.
So we were, for better or for worse, launched. And I tried to keep something happening. We went to a more electric rhythm section, even with some of the same people. And in 1970, I guess it was, we played the Fillmore East.
Wow.
The audience didn't know what to do with that. Because, you know, audiences even then had to be told what they liked.
Mm.
And I remember we'd finish a tune, there'd be a kind of roar, mm-hmm. but then a looking around to see if this was all right, and then a re-roar later. You know?
Like, is it okay to like this?
Yeah, by that time, we were called Gravity, and a friend of mine said, oh, Taj Mahal would love this sound. I said, really? Why would he?
We're going to have a good time tonight. You'll definitely have to put some shake in your shaker. A little quake in your quaker. A little rock in your sock. If you have been following this music for a while, you will note that this is one of the first major changes in the music, the addition of brass and percussion, and some new members.
Howard Johnson. John Hall.
Suspicious about catching the name. And I didn't know Tom.
Okay, yeah, because I thought it was interesting that you said he was a rock cat.
Yeah, right. Well, people who played the Fillmore.
Okay.
Which was, actually, I lived on East 6th Street in those days, and it was right across from the Fillmore. And she said, oh, I'm going to invite him to your next rehearsal. I said, yeah, okay. Taj came down and heard the sound. He said, I want to use that. And I said, yeah. We'll probably do that. I don't know if the all tuba format would be right for you, but I have guys who can play other instruments too, you know, and I play other instruments, and you have a pretty unique horn section, you know. And he said, yeah, and was very enthused. Now, I didn't take him that seriously. I didn't know how resolute and focused Taj Mahal was at that time. I didn't know him well enough to know that about him. But he came back from his summer in Ibiza and stayed at my house for a few days, and that's all he talked about, what we were going to do. And then I didn't hear from him for a while until right around Christmas, and he said, man, how much rehearsal time would we need before we could play an actual gig with the horns, you know? He said, are you kidding, man? With my guys, 2 weeks tops. And he said, yeah, we probably ought to start rehearsing like around January 1st, because we'll open Fillmore East on January 15th.
Oh, my goodness.
Then we go to Pittsburgh and open for Little Richard.
Oh, my.
Then we go to Fillmore West, and he had a tour.
Wow.
And I was like,
wow.
Oh, man. And the problem was, I didn't have a band. All of my guys were doing something else. Bob Stewart had a teaching job. Jack Jeffers was in Broadway and was an assistant conductor on a show. Morris Edwards had some leftover Johnson administration war on poverty gig in late 1970. You know, they were almost all gone. He was going to hang on to that money until it went away. You know,
wow.
So I basically didn't have a band.
Uh-huh.
And I called Bob Stewart to commiserate, and he was very unhappy to miss out on the opportunity, too. And the only one I could count on was Dave Bargeron. And I called Dave, and he said, oh, I guess you heard the news. I just joined Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
Oh, my goodness.
No, no. So I was pretty depressed. And the phone rang. It was Stuart. He said, man, I'm in.
Oh.
So I'll deal with the Board of Education later. But for now, count me in.
Excellent.
I was like, all right, Bob. So we remembered these two young guys who came to rehearsal and did really very well. It isn't easy to walk into that section and start playing if you're a tuba player, because mm-hmm. that's an experience like you're not going to have anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
So these guys, I felt they did all right.
And who were they?
Joe Daly and Earl McIntyre. So I called Joe Daly, and his wife told me he was at the Cheetah. So I went over there and talked to him. He was surprised to see me at the gig. And I told him what I wanted. He says, oh, I don't play tuba anymore.
What?
What do you mean? He said, well, I always thought it was pretty good. When I heard you and Bargeron and Stewart, I figured I can't play at all. I said, no, man, you were good. And besides, we need you now. You know?
Uh-huh.
So he had to think about that. I said, man, don't think about it, man. We need to do this. You know? So,
and now we can't imagine Joe Daly without a tuba.
Well, the other thing was he hadn't graduated from Manhattan School of Music yet. And it was his senior year. He was going to be the first of his family to graduate college.
Wow.
And his West Indian family wasn't going to hear no stuff.
Right, right.
So we finally got it all worked out. He told him at the school what he needed and how he'd work on whatever he had to work on. That got worked out. Harder was getting Earl McIntyre from his mother.
Oh, what?
Well, he was 17.
Oh, okay.
You know? And she wasn't going to just let him loose with a bunch of wild musicians.
Right.
So I talked to her. I said, well, you know, we're all going to be watching out for him. He'll have 9 big brothers on this band, you know, and you know, we're not a bunch of wild and crazy guys, you know, we're serious musicians like Earl is, you know. I wouldn't ask him to do anything that wasn't right. My children are small, but, you know, I'm a parent too, and she wasn't going for any of this.
She'd
say, yeah, you can say all you want, but if anything goes wrong, he's coming home. He's not 18. He's not emancipated.
Right.
Yeah. And so I said, well, you'll see. We'll take her. Yeah, I'll see all right. And he had done it one semester at Manus, but he got it arranged with the school also, you know. So.
Okay.
And then we did get together on January 1st or so and went to a place up in Woodstock with the rhythm section and worked out the parts. I did all the arranging without writing anything down.
Wow.
I said, your line goes like this, you play this, I'll play that, you play this.
It's sort of like working with your sister again.
Yeah. But I said, listen, we're going to have a microphone above us for the tuba. Mm-hmm. We're going to have a microphone in front of us with a flugelhorn and the trombone and stuff like that. I'm not taking any music stands or paper on the bandstand with us. So you learn this, and when we play it tomorrow, you have to remember your part, because I'm not going to try to remember yours. That wasn't really true, but I knew exactly what they were playing.
Sure.
But. So we opened the Fillmore, and Todd never knew how much that idea was in peril until he read those notes on the... Right Now CD.
Wow.
I even apologized in the notes. I said, sorry, man, I just didn't know you were that strong.
After hanging out with Taj Mahal and doing all of that with him, is that when you met Levon Helm?
It was in the same calendar year, the last week of December. We rehearsed and did, I think, from that, the live record called Rock of Ages.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was recorded over the 5 days we were there.
Oh, okay.
With Alan Toussaint's great arrangements.
Wow.
And that was pretty all right.
And then you continued to work with him over the years.
Yeah. I came back, you know, the movie The Last Waltz.
Right.
Those recordings.
Right. Scorsese.
A lot of people don't remember there was a Last Waltz tour also.
Oh, okay.
We did a lot of gigs all around the country, and it all culminated in a concert and film. And then after that, Levon had his own band called RCO All-Stars.
Right.
And I played in that band. And,
mm-hmm.
and then I think the last of that series of stuff, what was left of the band and who was interested in being there, in 1994, 25th anniversary of Woodstock, they had another Woodstock festival. I played that and a few other dates around it. I was still living in Germany. I moved to Germany in 91.
Oh.
And came back in 95.
Oh, okay. What made you do that?
That's a story.
Yeah.
I took the radio band job. They have those state-run radio stations in Germany for 4 years. Come in and play big band jazz for about 10 to 2, 5 days a week. And as I say, only not in America.
Okay. Now we're going to jump somewhere completely different because you mentioned the small children before. Nidra, your daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know how she wound up going into the blues area?
Somewhat.
And by the time this airs, she'll be at the Michigan Women's Festival.
Mm-hmm. She was mostly raised in California with her mother. And when she came to stay with me, I think she was already 18 and thoroughly punked out. Into Boy George, and the Dead Kennedys, and the Sex Pistols. And I was like, okay, that's my baby. I love her. And I came home one day and she... totally shocked me. She said she was very excited about some music she had heard. You know, and I thought, okay, is this going to be some blue hair and a spike through his lip? She said, I heard something great on the radio today. You ever hear of a guy named Louis Jordan?
Oh, wow.
I was like, Louis Jordan?
And you're listening to the final moments of Sugar in My Bowl. And as I mentioned before, yes, you could hear more about Nidra Johnson at sugarinmybowl.org.
S-U-G-A in my bowl dot O-R-G. And you can email me for information or songs that I didn't announce, or playlist. The playlist will be at Sugar in My Bowl, actually, but anyway, if you need to know a song before Wednesday, yeah, I think I put it back to Wednesday now, you can contact me at Sugar, S-U-G-A, in my bowl at gmail.com. That's Sugar in my bowl at gmail.com. Coming up next is La Nueva Alternativa. I just saw one of the brethren out there, and he should be in here very soon. And what you're listening to right now is John Lennon, Walls and Bridges. Yes, if you go to sugarmarble.org, you will find out the story that Howard Johnson has to share about his time with John Lennon. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Stay tuned for La Nueva Alternativa, coming up next.
Hi, this is Christian McBride, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.